This is our final session, and in this session I want to talk about the Christian solution to the puzzle of history. Before I begin, I want to give you references to two works on the philosophical side, which you may be interested in picking up so as to go into certain problems of the philosophy of history in more detail than we've been able to do in this course. The first of these is Donagan, D-O-N-A-G-A-N, Donagan, The Philosophy of History. This is a Macmillan paperback and is an excellent overview of philosophy of history from a philosophical standpoint. The second is an anthology edited by William H. Dray, who is the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Toronto and one of the foremost philosophers of history alive today, William H. Dray. And the title of this is Philosophical Analysis and History. This is in a Harper paperback series, and several of the articles in this are of great consequence for the sort of thing that we've been doing in this course, particularly the articles by Passmore, J.A. Passmore, on the objectivity of history, and Hempel's article on explanation in science and history. Both of these volumes reflect the most recent work done by analytical philosophers on the nature of history. And this work has been of great value because it has asked such questions as, what can be said about the meaning of history? What can actually be said to these larger questions, where is history going? And the general conclusion come to is that judgments in this area are going to be limited to the perspective of those making the judgments. These analytical philosophers are very much convinced that apart from some kind of universal perspective, philosophy of history cannot operate in the wide terms in which people thought it could in the 19th century. This is directly related to what we've been doing because we've tried to point out that there are three logical strikes against any secular philosophy of history at the very outset. The perspective is limited by the stance of the philosopher, and therefore it becomes necessary either to have some kind of word from outside the human situation, which will give this kind of broad perspective necessary, or it just isn't possible to make judgments in the area. Thus, Christian philosophy of history doesn't turn out to be an interesting possibility among other options. It turns out to be the only way you can get anywhere in this area, if you intend to. Now, in the last two sessions, we've been trying to bring this whole business into focus in terms of the historical evidence for the claims of Jesus Christ. Any Christian philosophy of history is going to center on Jesus Christ, who he was, and what his claims are. Any Christian philosophy of history, therefore, is going to depend upon the historicity of Christ. And we spent the session 2 weeks ago outlining the historical evidence in relation to Christ's claims. And we stressed the fact that this evidence is so good that if you're going to knock it, you must at the same time knock your knowledge of the classical world and a good deal of what you know about history in general. Because the same methods that are employed in vindicating historical events in the large are employed in vindicating the particular claims that are made in the New Testament documents. Then last week we talked about the question of the miraculous, and we endeavored to point out that one cannot begin with some kind of a philosophical presupposition against the miraculous and thereby get out from under the weight of the historical evidence. This question must be determined in the realm of testimony. It cannot be determined in the realm of a priori, in terms of what one already knows about the universe before investigating it. The only way to find out whether a miracle occurs is to check out the evidence in behalf of it. There are no techniques of avoiding the question by saying miracles are improbable or the weight of regularity is so great that irregularity does not need to be investigated. This sort of thing is out for the reasons that we went into in considerable detail last time. Now, the conclusion that we came to in all of this was that the claim of Christ in the New Testament to be God come to earth, to reveal the nature of man and the nature of history, and to save people from their self-centeredness that blinds them to the meaning of life, this claim has got to be taken with the utmost seriousness. The central event of Jesus' life is his resurrection from the dead. And that event is set out in the fabric of history as such. It isn't some kind of mystical, dreamy, ghostly affair which existed only for those who were weak enough to believe in it. It's something that occurred in fact and brought people around to belief in Christ who didn't believe in him prior to this. It may seem a little strange to conclude that kind of a discussion with the lines of a poet, but that's exactly what I'm going to do. John Updike, who is probably known to you for material which you would not consider especially theological, is nonetheless a Christian writer and Christian poet, and a few years ago he did a poem entitled Seven Stanzas at Easter. Seven Stanzas at Easter. And in this poem, he sums up exactly the point that we've been endeavoring to make in these last couple of sessions in regard to the historicity of these Christian claims, and specifically the claims in reference to the resurrection. This is what Updike writes. Make no mistake, if he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules reknit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. It was not as the flowers, each soft spring recurrent. It was not as his spirit in the mouths and fuddled eyes of 11 apostles. It was as his flesh, ours. The same hinged thumbs and toes, the same valved heart that pierced, died, withered, paused, and then regathered out of enduring might, new strength to enclose. Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping, transcendence, making of the event a parable, a sign painted in the faded credulity of earlier ages. Let us walk through the door. The stone is rolled back, not papier-mâché, not stone in a story, but the vast rock of materiality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. And if we will have an angel at the tomb, make it a real angel, weighty with Max Planck's quanta, vivid with hair, opaque in the dawn light, robed in real linen, spun on a definite loom. Let us not seek to make it less monstrous for our own convenience, our own sense of beauty, lest, awakened in one unthinkable hour, we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance. Updike, as any really great poet, subjects himself, first of all, to fact. It's out of fact that his poetry rises. He is unwilling to turn this event into something other than it really was for the sake of apparent canons of beauty. The beauty rises from what the thing actually was. We've been trying to make the point that the materiality or historicity of these events is central to them. And if this is the case, then Christ's judgment on the meaning of history stands. History does then turn out to be not a tale told by an idiot signifying nothing, but a tale told by God signifying everything. It begins in creation, it ends in final judgment, and it centers on the work of Christ himself. It isn't a cyclical recurring of meaninglessness. Not too long ago, I received a letter from the Foundation for the Study of Cycles in Pittsburgh. Dear sir, as you well know, almost everything fluctuates in cycles. Your moods vary from cheerful to gloomy, They were quite right. I began to feel gloomy at that point as I was reading the letter. Weather goes from good to bad. Prices go up and down. War alternates with peace. Good business is followed by depression. When you study behavior of this sort in detail, you find that many of these alterations, these cycles, come at reasonably regular time intervals, underlined. For example, many mammals are more abundant at about 9.6-year intervals, which mammals we are not told. Some birds, some fishes, and some insects also have this cycle. Even human populations increase and slow down their rapid growth in a regular fashion, every 17 2/3 years in the United States. People flock to join the Protestant churches at about 9-year intervals. Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Methodists, Congregationalists all have the same cycle, that's underlined, regardless of geography. We are due for a peak of this cycle next year. Genius, parentheses, creativity, closing parentheses, often flowers at 7.6 month intervals, or at half that length of time. This was discovered by examining diaries kept by famous artists such as Keats, Shelley, Mozart, Goethe, Victor Hugo, Bronte, which one is not indicated, and many, many others. Maybe your creativity too comes in cycles. It's easy for you to find out. And so on. Then comes the pitch, of course, to join this insane organization. Now, one of the values of coming down to a clearer view as to the nature of the historical process is to recognize that where cycles do genuinely exist, these are minor themes. They are not major themes. The fact of the matter is that such cyclical activities as these, to the extent that they can be justified, do not in themselves explain the human drama. They provide some degree of light on a limited scale. But the fact of the matter is that Christ, who entered this world from outside and who could see the whole business, not just a limited cyclical relationship at a particular point of history, indicates that the process goes on to a final terminus, and that terminus is going to be one for everybody. In my book, Where is History Going?, I've talked a bit about the implications of this Christian view of history, and I don't want to go into those implications on a wider scale at this point. What I'm interested in doing tonight is to talk about the relationship of this general question as to the meaning of history in relationship to our personal existence. Now, you say, wait a minute here, I thought we were talking about history. We weren't talking about somebody's personal existence, and furthermore, I begin to feel a little bit edgy, because it sounds like this thing is departing from general categories and possibly getting down to me. Well, that's just about it. But there is eminently good justification for this. One of the finest works on the philosophy of history to come out in recent years is Erich Kähler's The Meaning of History. This is published by Brasilier, or Boisier, and in this work, the author, who is a philosopher of considerable renown, not a Christian philosopher, makes one central point. And this central point is that philosophy of history is a general case of personal philosophy of life. Or, turning it around, one's attitude toward one's own personal life is directly related to one's view of history. This is a mutually implicating operation. The way in which people look at history is related to the way in which they look at their personal lives. The personal lives of individuals often turn out to be the basis for the generalizations that are made about history. We haven't placed much stress in this course on the existential approach to history because of certain basic methodological difficulties with that approach. But the existentialist is quite right that there is a tie-in between one's personal history and history in general. This is how Kähler ends his book. The problem of the meaning of history is the problem of the meaning of man, the problem of a meaning of human life. And this is quite correct. There's no sense in talking about the meaning of history apart from the meaning of human life. These are directly tied together. As Toynbee said in the film we saw some weeks ago, what is history apart from the individual lives that make it up? Thus, it becomes essential to tie this whole business down to the meaning of one's personal life. Now, a reaction that some people have in relation to the kind of material we've been presenting the last couple of weeks is, so who needs it, man? All right, so there is a great deal of evidence in behalf of Jesus. So it appears that he was a certain kind of person. What difference does this make to me personally? The larger statement of this is, what difference does this mean to human life in general? Well, it makes every difference in the world. Jesus claimed that the only way to get at truth, in the most basic sense of the word, was in a proper relationship with him. He said, I am the way and the truth and the life. People came to him, religious leaders of his time, and they said, we are not in bondage to any man. Now, this was a pretty stupid thing to say, really, because the Roman legions were tromping up and down outside while they were saying this. The fact of the matter is that Israel was totally within the military control of the Romans, and by 70 AD, the city of Jerusalem is leveled by these Romans. They were in bondage. But, of course, the bondage went a good deal deeper than that. Jesus said, in reply to this, he who commits sin is the servant of sin. If the Son shall make you free, Christ himself, if the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. If you continue in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. If you trot up to USC, you will find the very tail end of that quotation on the facade of the library. And you will find that on the facade of many libraries of universities hither and thither. I must say that it strikes a note of irony with me when I see this, because supposedly universities are trying to get students not to quote out of context. You know? And yet there is probably no more unfortunate instance of quoting out of context than taking just the last line of that. Jesus says, if you continue in my word, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. This isn't a statement about general discovery of truth. It's a statement about how you get the right kind of perspective. And only with that right kind of perspective does truth enter into the picture in the proper sense. The point of all of this is that Jesus was saying the people of his day who thought that they were not in bondage to anybody didn't recognize that they were in bondage to themselves. Their sin, or we might put it today, their egocentricity, their selfishness, had blinded them from seeing the world as it really was, and had blinded them from seeing themselves as they really were. Now Jesus claimed to be God Almighty, come down to earth, and he lived a perfect life. He said to people, which of you convinces me of sin? And nobody could answer him. And as a result of living this perfect life, he didn't have to die for himself. Death was not necessary for him. His life was a life of perfection, and therefore it wasn't necessary for him to take any consequences from this. Thus, he was in a position to do what nobody else could do. He took cosmically on himself the self-centeredness and the evil of everybody from the beginning of history to the end. And he canceled the penalty for this sort of thing out in his death on the cross. He claimed to come to give his life a ransom for many. Now, he offered himself to people so that if they would accept that tremendous gift, then they would be freed from the self-centered perspective that they'd had. This is why it's possible to be freed on the basis of a relationship with him. It's a freedom from self-centeredness, and on the basis of this, a person can see himself as he really is, which means seeing himself as God sees him. Not the hot shot that he thinks he is, but rather the person who desperately needs the kind of salvation, to use the biblical term, that Christ presented. This means that what we've been talking about these last several weeks is directly relevant to individual human life, and therefore it's directly relevant to human life in general, and to history in general. Let me illustrate this by way of a littérateur who is not as well known as he ought to be, but who is becoming more and more well known. This is Jorge Luis Borges. Borges is an Argentinian. He is now blind. For years he was the librarian of the Argentine National Library, and he has not written a great deal, but his writings have been translated into English, into French, and critical material on him is coming out to greater and greater extent every year. This work, Dream Tigers, collects a number of his things, translates them from the Spanish, and is published by the University of Texas, where Borges spent a term in residence. One of the selections in this work expresses very clearly the human dilemma, the dilemma that lies at the heart of history and at the heart of the human lives that make up history. This selection is entitled Borges and I, written by Borges. Now listen closely. I'll comment on this afterwards, but listen closely. It's the other one, it's Borges, that things happen to. I stroll about Buenos Aires and stop, perhaps mechanically now, to look at the arch of an entrance or an iron gate. News of Borges reaches me through the mail, and I see his name on an academic ballot or in a biographical dictionary. I like hourglasses, maps, 18th century topography, the taste of coffee, and Stevenson's prose. The other one shares these preferences with me, but in a vain way that converts them into the attributes of an actor. It would be too much to say that our relations are hostile. I live, I allow myself to live, so that Borges may contrive his literature, and that literature justifies my existence. I do not mind confessing that he has managed to write some worthwhile pages. But those pages cannot save me, perhaps because the good part no longer belongs to anyone, not even to the other one, but rather to the Spanish language or to tradition. Otherwise, I am destined to be lost, definitively, and only a few instants of me will be able to survive in the other one. Little by little, I am yielding to him in everything, although I am well aware of his perverse habit of falsifying and exaggerating. Spinoza held that all things long to preserve their own nature. The rock wants to be a rock forever, and the tiger a tiger. But I must live on in Borges, not in myself, if indeed I am anyone, though I recognize myself less in his books than in many others, or than in the laborious strumming of a guitar. Years ago, I tried to free myself from him, and I passed from lower middle-class myths to playing games with time and infinity. But those games are Borges now, and I will have to conceive of something else. Thus my life is running away, and I lose everything, and everything belongs to oblivion, or to the other one. I do not know which of us two is writing this page. Now what's going on here? Borges has recognized an experience that every one of us has, and that is universal. It's an experience that lies at the heart of history because it lies at the heart of human lives. It's the experience of being different externally from what we are internally. Or, putting it another way, it's the difference between who we really are and who other people think we are. The difference between me as I am in myself and the judgment that others will ultimately have of me. Borges finds himself reading about Borges in the biographical dictionary. It's true, yes, but it isn't Borges. Yet that's the only place that Borges is going to survive. He's going to survive in the entries in the biographical dictionaries. He's going to survive in the things that he has written. But the minute that they are written, they are not Borges any longer. And they do not perfectly represent him. He is missing from them. Early in his career, he occupied himself, he says, with lower middle class myths. And recognizing this and seeing himself externalized as lower middle class myths, he shifted to the poetry and writing that this selection represents. He moved from there to, as he says, playing games with time and infinity. But lo and behold, those games are Borges now, and I will have to conceive of something else. Yet, of course, he knows that he can't conceive of anything that will not have exactly that same result. And for this reason, he says, that he is destined to be lost, to lose everything. Thus my life is running away, and I lose everything, and everything belongs to oblivion. Nothing that I do, says he, is capable of saving me. I am destined to be lost, definitively. Now, history is an objective record of what's happened. It's possible for us to determine the events of the past within the framework of the remaining evidence. But of course, in a very real sense, we are not preserving the reality of what happened. We are preserving the remains of it. What we see is the footprints left on the sand after history has passed. Like Robinson Crusoe, we see the prints of Friday on the sand. The existentialist historians have often said, our task really in history is to recreate the past, to enter into it, to re-experience it, to look through the lighted window, as Trevelyan said, to look through the lighted window into the warm room of the past where events are taking place. But of course, we always look through the glass, don't we? And it's a glass through which we see darkly. Somehow, history has gone, and the people who made it up have gone. And then the ghastly thought occurs to us that that's exactly what's happening to us. Sure, we can change from middle-class myths to playing with time and infinity, but that's not going to save us. That's not going to preserve us from this oblivion. We're falling into it as every instant passes. This central problem of history is the human predicament, the finitude, the limitation that exists. The fact that no matter how much huffing and puffing we engage in, we cannot stop the clock from moving on. And what's left is the other Borges. If you don't think that you need what Jesus Christ offers, then you don't understand this. And if you don't understand this, you don't understand yourself. The only way to be preserved from this kind of oblivion is by latching on to somebody who isn't subject to it. There's only one way to get past that, and that's to be pulled out of this kind of situation by one who is not himself subject to exactly that problem. There wasn't any schizophrenia of that kind with Jesus. When people had contact with Jesus, the thing that appalled them, among other things, was that he was a completely transparent person. He wasn't a different person on the outside from the person he was on the inside. He wasn't, in other words, a hypocrite. And the Borges and I problem is, to a certain extent, viewed from one angle, the problem of hypocrisy. The people who disliked Jesus the most were the people who were engaged in the most systematic kind of hypocrisy. Those who were attempting to set forth 89,312 external regulations and giving external fulfillment to them so that other people would feel that everything was grand as far as their interior self was concerned. When Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount, these people just about lost their minds because Jesus said, so you haven't committed adultery. If you have looked at a woman to lust after her, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. In talking with students at various places, I have seldom, that's putting it too mildly, I have never found anybody who doesn't snigger at that as far as his relationship to it is concerned. Sure, you haven't committed adultery, but you mean to tell me you've never lusted in your heart? You've never thought you'd like to do that sort of thing? When Jesus mentioned that kind of thing, the people of his day who were listening either recognized that they were that sort of person, admitted it, and came to terms with him, or They tried to crucify him and eventually did so in order to get rid of somebody who saw the difference between what was going on inside of them and what was going on outside. This problem of oblivion is a problem that can be dealt with only by the person who conquered such oblivion. Jesus Christ's resurrection is the evidence, that materiality of the resurrection is the evidence that one can be carried beyond that point, and history can be carried beyond that point. If we had time in this course, we would talk a bit about what the Bible refers to as the millennium, that is, God's establishment ultimately of a vindication of himself right here within the historical process. We're not going to go into that here, but the point is that it is possible for both history and the individuals who make it up to get past this oblivion, but it's possible only in contact with the one who conquered death. Now, if this is the case, and people need this so much, why are there so many non-Christians around? Why are there so many people who don't go along with this? There are two possible answers to it. First of all, the evidence really isn't any good. And for this reason, people are not Christians. If we've tried to do anything in this course, we've tried to show that that alternative is out. One can't take that alternative. The other possibility is that people either don't know what the evidence is, or they don't want to know what the evidence is. Since, apparently, if you are here, you're not in the category of those who haven't had contact with the evidence, I won't bother to discuss that. But I do want to spend a few minutes at the very end of this final session on the matter of not wanting to know what the evidence is. Some of you heard Ray Bradbury speaking at Southwestern College a couple of weeks ago. Bradbury did a short story some years ago entitled The Man. The Man. This is a very interesting short story, and it makes exactly the point that I want to make in relationship to this business of how one treats the evidence. In this story, the captain of a spacecraft arrives in a distant galaxy and lands on a planet, and he is the first person to come from another world into that world. This is his big moment. He's been looking forward to this, his opportunity to become a Columbus in relation to another world. And what happens? People are indifferent. Why? Because an incarnation occurred on their world just a couple of days before. God came to Earth there on that world and did the same sort of thing that he did when he came to Earth in the person of Jesus Christ on ours. And the people are still living in the glow of God's appearance. Thus, the arrival of the captain in his space vessel is not considered to be at all the kind of event that the captain thought it would be. Let me read you a bit from the story. The story begins with a discussion between the captain and a member of his crew. And the member of the crew says this, "Why do we do it, Martin? This space travel, I mean. Always on the go, always searching, our insides always tight, never any rest. Maybe we're looking for peace and rest. Certainly there's none on Earth," said Martin. "No, there's not." Captain Hart was thoughtful. "Not since Darwin, eh? Not since everything went by the board, everything we used to believe in, eh? Divine power and all that. And so you think maybe that's why we're going out to the stars, eh, Martin? Looking for our lost souls. Is that it?" And then the ship lands, and they discover that this incarnation has occurred. Naturally, the captain is appalled by this. He is irritated beyond description, and he wants to find out what this person was like. And he asks, well, he was a man for whom the people there had waited a long time, a million years maybe. And yesterday he walked into their city. That's why today, sir, our rocket landing means nothing. He didn't arrive in his rocket before us and steal my glory, did he? What was his name? He didn't have a name, sir. He didn't need one. It would be different on any planet, on every planet, sir. I don't get this. The captain confronted Martin, peered down into his face and eyes. You've been drinking, eh? He was suspicious. He backed away. Martin looked at the city. Captain, if you don't understand, there's no way of telling you. I don't believe it, the captain said at last. At high noon, Captain Hart walked briskly into the city, accompanied by Lieutenant Martin and an assistant who was carrying some electrical equipment. Every once in a while, he laughed loudly, put his hands on his hips, and shook his head, eyes shut. The mayor of the town confronted him. Martin set up a tripod, screwed onto it a box, and switched on the batteries. Are you the mayor? The captain jabbed a finger out. I am, said the mayor. The delicate apparatus stood between them, controlled and adjusted by Martin and the assistant. Instantaneous translations from one language were made by the box. The words sounded crisply on the mild air of the city. About this occurrence yesterday, said the captain. It occurred? It did. You have witnesses? We have. May we talk to them? Talk to any of us, said the mayor. We are all witnesses. Aside to Martin, the captain said, mass hallucination. What did he look like? I don't believe that's important, replied the mayor. It's very important, said the captain sternly. I want a description of the fellow. If I can't get it from you, I'll get it from others. To Martin, I'm sure it must have been Burton pulling one of his practical jokes. This is Burton, who was the competitor of the captain in reaching this world. Martin would not look him in the face. Martin was coldly silent. The captain snapped his fingers. There was something or other, a healing? Many healings, said the mayor. May I see one? You may, said the mayor. My son. He nodded a small boy who stepped forward. He was afflicted with a withered arm. Now look at it. At this, the captain laughed tolerantly. Yes, yes, this isn't even circumstantial evidence, you know. I didn't see the boy's withered arm. I see only his arm whole and well. That's no proof. What proof have you that the boy's arm was withered yesterday and today as well? My word is my proof, said the mayor simply. My dear man, cried the captain, you don't expect me to go on hearsay, do you? I'm sorry, said the mayor, looking upon the captain with what appeared to be curiosity and pity. Do you have any pictures of the boy before today? Asked the captain. After a moment, a large oil portrait was carried forth, showing the son with a withered arm. My dear fellow, the captain waved it away, anybody can paint a picture. Painting's why. I want a photograph of the boy. There was no photograph. Photography was not a known art in their society. Neither was it a known art in the first century. See? Well, sighed the captain, his face beginning to twitch. A slight tick appearing now, you see. Let me talk to a few other citizens. We're getting nowhere. He pointed at a woman. You, she hesitated. Yes, you come here, ordered the captain. Tell me about this wonderful man you saw yesterday. Martin flinched at the sarcasm in his words. The woman looked steadily at the captain. He walked among us and was good. What color were his eyes? The color of the sun, the color of the sea, the color of a flower, the color of the mountains, the color of night. That'll do, the captain threw up his hand. See, Martin, absolutely nothing. Some charlatan wanders through, whispering sweet nothings in their ears, and please stop it, said Martin, breaking out. The captain stepped back. What? You heard what I said, said Martin. I like these people. I believe what they say. You're entitled to your opinion, but you can keep it to yourself, sir. You can't talk to me that way, shouted the captain. I've had enough of your high-handedness, replied Martin. Leave these people alone. They've got something good and decent, and you come and foul up the nest and sneer at it. Well, I've talked to them, too. I've gone through the city, and I've seen their faces, and they've got something you'll never have. Now, at the end of the story, the captain goes off half-demented in his rocket, trying to find another world where he can be the Columbus.